The Tom Woods Show, episode 880.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
If your homeschool program is making you crazy and running you ragged, don't wait till next term to fix it. Check out the self-taught Ron Paul curriculum right now. Plus, get $160 worth of free bonuses when you join through my link, ronpaulhomeschool.com. Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here. Today, I am sharing with you my recent appearance on the Lions of Liberty podcast. That's my second appearance on that podcast, hosted by the great Mark Clare. It's a podcast I think you will enjoy. I will have a link to it at tomwoods.com/880. But for now, just know that their website is lionsofliberty.com, and you can subscribe to that podcast in all the usual places. We talk about some interesting stuff, first about podcasting, but then we talk about all kinds of libertarian stuff, and he is riffing off my Sane Space book. I wrote a free ebook called Sane Space, Libertarian Dispatches from Bizarro America. And we talk a bit about that. Of course, you can grab that book. Don't cost you nothing. You can grab it at sanespacebook.com. All right, here we go. And then after that, I've got an interesting announcement that you may find interesting. That's why I said it was interesting. So check it out at the end of the interview. And here we go.
I am pleased to welcome back the one, the only, Tom Woods. Tom, are you ready to roar?
You betcha, Mark. Glad to be here.
Now, Tom, it's been about 2 years or so since you were last on the show, and the Tom Woods Show has really solidified itself as one of the top libertarian podcasts out there, really one of the top political podcasts out there, if you ask me, and you interview a wide variety of guests on a wide variety of liberty-related topics 5 days a week, a phenomenal feat, and you continually put these shows out on such a consistent basis, so I'm just curious, is there one guest or one subject in particular that really just gets you fired up and gets you to that extra level of excitement for an interview?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, maybe foreign policy. I'd like to know more about it. I feel like I probably know more than the average person, but the more I know about it, the more convinced I am that my position is correct. So I am interested in stuff like that. But what really interests me about all this is that I can still be going well into the 870s in terms of number of episodes and not be running out of topics. That is really what amazes me more than anything else, is that there's so much to discuss. And I'll still be talking about brand new things that have never been covered in nearly 1,000 episodes.
It really is amazing, especially hearing that your number. I think you said 870 or so, and I'm here patting myself on the back for nearing the 300 mark here. But that is something I learned, because go ahead.
Well, I was going to say that is great. That is a great achievement, given that most podcasts don't make it past episode number 7.
Right,
now, if they
right.
get past episode 7, they may have some longevity. It's sort of like life expectancy figures. If a person gets past age 5 or 10, that person is likely to live to 75 or 80, that sort of thing. But, you know, it's the people who don't live to age 5 who way bring down all the numbers. Well, likewise, if you were to do an average of how many episodes a podcast has, it's not that large. But when you get rid of all the podcasters who give up after episode 3, you get into this elite group where there are a lot of episodes. But it's an elite group. A lot of people just quit doing it.
Sure. I think a lot of podcasters are probably self-critical. I mean, there's not an episode of my own that I can go back and listen to that I don't cringe at some point, whether I just misspoke or said something wrong or asked a question in a way that sounded weird to me. So it's very easy to almost give up. I mean, early on, I almost want to just say, forget this whole experiment. But the continuing on is really the biggest feature of a successful podcaster, because that's what differentiates the good from the bad, the wheat from the chaff, the people that continue to put those episodes in out on a continuous basis.
And by the way, it is harder than it looks. So
yes.
if you find that there are bits and pieces of it here and there that aren't exactly the way you would have liked them if you had been able to rehearse it 12 times, well, most people couldn't do any better.
Yeah, it will never, ever be perfect, especially to yourself, to the one going back and listening to things, because I think we're all just far more critical of the way we do things, the way we produce our own products, than we would be of, say, our guests or anybody else or any other podcast that we would listen to.
Right, right, right. So I'm really thrilled about your success. Good for you. I mean, there's plenty of room for all of us in this world.
Yeah, and like you said, it's an amazing thing because when you first become a libertarian, Murray Rothbard has a whole speech about this. You actually think you're the only libertarian at first. You think that there's maybe you and whatever author you first read, and that's about it. And it's only as you kind of go along into the movement, especially, I mean, I became a libertarian before the Ron Paul era, before he really exploded it into mainstream ideas. So before that time, I really did think there was only maybe four or five libertarians out there. So it amazes me that people like you are able to near 1,000 episodes. I'm nearing 300 episodes, and there are many, many other libertarian podcasts doing similar things, and they're all producing unique content and with unique people, with hundreds and hundreds of other people that are actually out there, not just being libertarians, but these people all have books and projects and podcasts and movies and documentaries of their own. It really does make you realize, okay, I'm not insane, which ties into your book.
And let's not forget, it's not a fixed number. I get so much email from people saying they became libertarians or harder core libertarians specifically because they listened to my show. A friend tipped them off about it. They said, all right, I'll listen to an episode or two. They wound up listening to all 870, whatever. And it changed the way they think. So a lot of times you and I get no doubt accused of preaching to the choir. But for one thing, the choir sometimes bring friends to church,
right?
You know, so that's one thing. Secondly, even if we were just preaching to the choir, this is one of my constant themes, by the way, there's nothing wrong with that, because I don't know of any church on earth where when it comes time for the preaching, the pastor says to the choir, hey, why don't you guys go out and have a cigarette? I'm going to be preaching. The choir is preached to every Sunday with good reason, that the choir also needs to be strengthened in what it is that they believe. And in our case, our choir needs to be equipped with arguments and ways to handle themselves in debate and knowledge so that we can be more effective. There's no shame whatsoever in preaching to the choir, even if that were what we were doing.
And to continue that analogy, I mean, the choir isn't necessarily always singing the exact same song at the exact same pitch. I mean, we have different songs in our little church here, in our little choir. We have different pitches, different ways to sing maybe some of the same ideals out. So it makes perfect sense to continue the conversation because it's really never over. And Tom, as I mentioned at the top of the show, you recently put out this book entitled Sane Space, which collects some of your emails focusing on a lot of your personal interactions with the left and those you might call social justice warriors. And this is a term that's tossed around a lot. Some of my more lefty friends will say, you know, why is being a social justice warrior such a bad thing? Aren't you libertarians for justice? So how do you define a social justice warrior, and how do you see their view of the term justice differing from the libertarian view of justice?
Well, I actually don't like the term social justice warrior, and I've said that on my show for this reason, because it actually makes them sound, even though it makes them sound a bit quixotic, at the same time, it makes them sound, well, you know, even if a bit too idealistic, basically on the right track. Who wouldn't be a warrior for justice? If we believe in justice, who wouldn't be a warrior for it? So I think the term gives them much too much credit. I mean, I don't know what the correct term for them is, but it would not be quite that complimentary. No, what's wrong with them, of course, is their view that there really isn't another point of view. Now, it's true, libertarians can fall into this too, but I think by and large, we know what progressives believe. Sometimes we read their websites, sometimes we've read some of their books. We're at least somewhat familiar with what they have to say. The social justice warrior is somebody who genuinely thinks there is the correct position and there is wickedness and oppression. And there can't be anybody in between. And there can't be any good reason. There cannot be any good reason to hold a view other than theirs, other than obviously you just want to oppress people and you hate people and you're insensitive and you're a jerk. There can't be a legitimate difference of opinion. And what's wrong with that, of course, is that if there can't be a legitimate difference of opinion, that means we can't have debates, which means all we have is shouting people down and violent suppression of ideas. If it's a metaphysical impossibility that we could ever meet on a level playing field and have an exchange of ideas, well, what are we going to do instead other than have physical altercations? And that there's no way you can defend that or think that's admirable. It's not.
Absolutely. And I recently had Jordan Peterson on the program. I know you had him as a guest as well. And I mean, he'll show up somewhere to have a scheduled debate at a university that wants to have him. I think recently, actually, a couple people backed out of a debate with him because of threats of violence. And he still showed up and people just showed up to shout him down. He couldn't even get a word in edgewise because they're not interested in a debate. If they're interested in a debate, that would be fantastic. I'd love to have the debate. I know you have a passion for having these debates. But when they show up and just scream and tell you you should not be heard, that's a whole different animal. And if you can't be heard, if you can't express your views through words, like you said, there's only one thing left, and that's the fists. And that's very dangerous.
Now, on the other hand, you can always exploit that type of situation by getting the YouTube video and spreading it around. Even though the people in that particular audience didn't get a chance to hear you, an audience 10, 100,000 times as large will get a chance to see the viral video. And you've got a decent chance of having your video go viral when it's a video of a peaceful person being shouted down. And of course, now those social justice warriors will say you're not really peaceful because if you don't want to use the right gender pronouns, you're implicitly committing violence. But I think most people think there's a difference between not using strange words that begin with X on the one hand and kicking somebody in the teeth in the other. I think most people can see there's a real difference between those things. And so I'm actually going to be speaking in early April of this year at Yale University. And my view is if I am not shouted down or in some way physically prevented from speaking, my appearance will have been at least partially a failure.
Have you ever had an experience similar to that of Dr. Jordan Peterson or even someone like Milo? Obviously, you haven't had anything that extreme, but have you had people that show up to events of yours that have just shouted you down?
No, that's never happened. That's partly because I'm not as well known as those people. I don't speak on top. I mean, you know, if I go talk about the Federal Reserve, what kind of person's going to show up and shout me down over that? You know, you'd have to be even more of a blockhead to do that. So, but on the other hand, I haven't done that much university speaking over the past couple of years, and it's my impression that things have gotten exponentially worse over the past couple of years. I think I was speaking during a time, I think it was basically a paradise in those days. So I think the tone definitely has changed, and we'll see. But as I say, I'm not an Ann Coulter. I'm not Milo. Jordan Peterson got some notoriety because of the controversy surrounding him. I'm just an unknown, relatively speaking, so that means I can sort of get away with it.
And it really is frightening when you think about the fact that a lot of this comes from our universities, which is supposed to be the place where the next generation really develops their deeper level ideas, their develops their philosophy, thinks deeper about political issues. And yet what we're seeing, and this obviously doesn't apply to everybody that goes to universities at all, I'm sure it's a minority, but in a way it's a minority supported by the majority, supported by a lot of the philosophy espoused by their teachers. So it really is a top-down thing in many ways. And this relates directly to the title of your book, Sane Space, obviously playing on the safe space term that we've heard out there, where people just need to be protected from certain ideas, which is why they show up at events by Jordan Peterson, Milo, and shout them down, because they need protection not from violence, from ideas. And that's a very scary thought. I do want to touch on a few of the sort of little notes in your book here. These are from your email newsletter and then highlight a lot of your encounters with social justice warriors and with just sort of leftist ideas. One of them is really interesting because it's something you see in meme form all the time. And that's the idea. You always see a meme that just says, enjoying your weekends? Well, better thank the labor unions. That's with my own little sarcastic sort of tone put on there, but that's the way I read it. So when you see that, and what is the response to that idea? The idea that labor unions specifically are the entire reason that we have weekends at all.
Yeah, they are not the reason we have weekends. Just think of it this way. Do you think people in Bangladesh could suddenly have weekends off if all they had to do was just organize into labor unions? Or they could all have massages at work and have a 5-hour workday if all they needed was the code of federal regulations imposed in their country? Now, to the contrary, this would impoverish them even further. People would be starving to death if you imposed the code of federal regulations on them. And if you tried to unionize them, thinking that this will get them extra time off, what you're really trying to do is take a country that's extremely primitive in the tools it has, the capital goods it has to produce stuff, and say, well, a lot of the stuff you're producing is done with your bare hands, so it's very inefficient, and that's why you're poor, and that's why you got to work 24 hours a day just to create bare subsistence for yourselves. But you know what? We're going to tell you not to work a couple of days. The reason they work so hard is not because evil men with white mustaches wearing a monocle are arbitrarily demanding that they work hard. They're working in basically more or less pre-industrial conditions. Of course, everybody has to work all those hours just to be able to produce the raw goods necessary to give everybody a minimally acceptable standard of living. What those people need is capitalists who will take their profits, invest them in machines. The machines make the workers more physically productive, which means more output, which puts downward pressure on prices, which means now their paychecks can extend farther and they can be wealthier. That's the process that has delivered everybody on earth from poverty. Simply introducing, for heaven's sake, labor unionism misses the point so badly, only a university educated student could come up with it.
isn't the idea of even guaranteed days off, just period, sort of a sign that a society has really progressed to a very privileged point in a way, not to use a social justice term. But I mean, we're very lucky that we've progressed in a way through capitalism, although not that we have a fully capitalist society here in the United States, obviously. But we've been able to progress because we are at a point where we have the wealth where we can take days off. We can actually have days where we don't work, whereas 150, 200 years ago, days off? Are you kidding me? I mean, people had to get up and go create their food and go farm and make sure that they were able to live through that very day. So it's definitely a sign of society progressing, but to actually point to labor unions being responsible, well, there's simply no evidence for that.
Yeah, because basically what happens is people begin in a situation where they work long hours in very undesirable conditions. That's true of every civilization everywhere. That's how it starts, because if you don't do that, there won't be enough goods produced to support everybody. But then you get to a level where you can now start making trade-offs. You can say, I could work, you know, let's say, you know, 100 hours a week, and I could get more money by working 100 hours a week. I could do that now, but I don't want to. I have enough money that I would be willing to sacrifice some additional money in exchange for leisure or better working conditions. I mean, anybody listening to this right now could probably work 100 hours a week, but you choose not to most of the time, even though you could earn more money, because it proves to you there is something more valuable to you than money. Well, the reason for that is that you've gotten to a point where your society is rich enough that you have enough money to be able to splurge, in effect, on leisure. Now, that's great. I'm glad we're at that position. But a lot of people in the world are not. And I have a friend who's at Texas Tech University, Ben Powell, who actually bothered to ask people, instead of trying to improve people's lives without their consent or without asking what they prefer, he actually bothered to go to a couple of places in Guatemala that are considered sweatshops. And he said, look, in exchange for a very small reduction in your pay, would you want a commensurate increase in your work, improvement in your working conditions? Or would you want X amount of time off? Or would you want the following things? Overwhelmingly, I mean, almost all the answers to these questions were 95%+. No, we wouldn't want that at this stage in our lives. And they didn't quite put it this way, but at this stage in our economic development, we want the money. We don't want all these fringe benefits. It's much better for us to get the cash, and then we'll spend the cash the way we want. Someday we might want these other things, but right now you would be making us worse off by forcing us to accept them. How about that?
Because they actually value the money they're getting over these extra luxuries that some people here living in mansions in the United States would like to impose upon them.
Exactly. And they don't bother to take the 2 minutes it would require to think of what the likely outcome of this would be. Obviously, it would make these people worse off. So Ben actually goes and asks them, do you think you'd be better off or worse off? And they're all saying, of course we'd be worse off. And as David R. Henderson puts it, he's an economist I like, he says, you don't help the poor by taking their list of options and then eliminating the option they actually chose.
Well, Tom, obviously they're only saying that because someone is literally standing behind them with a whip threatening them while Ben Powell is standing there talking to them. That's the only possible explanation I can think of for this.
Yeah, of course.
Tom, I want to move on. And this one, it hurt my head to read the first time, so it might hurt my head to hear you talk about it. But I think we need to do it anyway, because it's a very frightening attitude that I actually see a lot, even among regular human beings. But can you tell us about your exchange with a leftist who casually, I love your title here, who casually favors the deaths of billions?
Oh, yeah. I remember I was on vacation with my kids last year.
Even on vacation, you can't stay out of this stuff.
I couldn't. They were attacking. It was on my own. I think it was on my Facebook wall. And I don't even use that. I use my so-called fan page. Well, anyway, it was one of these. It was a person who had been an anarcho-capitalist who'd become an anarcho-communist and had become literally and explicitly, I was not making this up, anti-civilization. Her argument was that civilization is the source of all our problems. It's why we're depressed. It's why we're unhappy. And so I was, you know, having a little fun at her expense saying, well, if you think you'd be less depressed living in a mud hut, go ahead and do it. There's nobody stopping you. You can go live in the interior of the jungle somewhere and build a hut and live in self-sufficiency. Why don't you do that instead of making all of us do that? Because if you made all of us do that, probably billions of people would drop dead. And I never really got a good reply to why that was something to be avoided, because I don't think she thought that was something to be avoided. And I thought, I didn't think people like this actually exist. I mean, it turns out there's a whole group of people who are literally anti-civilization. and every comfort you can imagine in civilization, they want to get rid of. I always thought this was a figment of the extreme right wing's imagination. Obviously, people like this aren't really out there. And they were, and so I just had fun going after them. And then, of course, all my comments were deleted, as always happens in Facebook land. So you think, oh, that's gone forever. But I'm always looking for email fodder because I send out that newsletter every weekday, or at least now, you know, I have 5 kids. So when I don't send out a newsletter in a particular day, it just means I was spending extra time with them or something. But I thought to myself, well, if I don't have it on Facebook anymore, I have it in the old noodle that I can use in an email, which I did.
They can't delete that.
You're darn right.
Now, Tom, and it really is like a hallmark of the left in many ways. And again, I don't like to paint broad brushes too much, but at least of the extreme sort of environmental element of the left, it's a very anti-human attitude. It basically says that literally, I mean, some of them will literally say dirt and ants are more important than humans because humans are a destructive force on the world. Everything we do is destroying the earth. So we need to reduce humans. We need to, and so we can have more dirt and ants. And obviously a lot of them really want more fish and more deer. And libertarians want that too, but they don't want it at the expense of the lives of millions and billions of human beings is the difference, I would say.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is obviously not even something worth arguing because it's self-evidently ridiculous. Nobody would want to live this way. Even the vast majority of leftists would never want to live this way. If leftists had to live that way, they would not have the leisure time they now have to condemn capitalism because they'd have to spend all their time making their own clothes and growing their own food and everything. They'd never get around to it. So they like the leisure time that modern civilization has made possible. That otherwise, how would they have jobs where they have to teach for 6 hours a week and then they can sit in their offices blogging all day? You know, where else? How's that going to happen without civilization?
Right. Yeah. How are they going to be Facebooking Tom Woods if we didn't have any of these societal advantages that they'd like to
eliminate? Indeed. Yes.
Tom, you have all these encounters with the left and obviously you originally came from the right. So I think that's one reason you're, you know, more comfortable sort of arguing against the right because you know the arguments because you used to make those very same arguments yourself. And you recently had a conversation with Dave Smith on your program about reaching out to the left. And he's been on our show before. And he is different from you in the sense that he actually came from the left. He was actually a progressive before Tom Woods and some other people sort of turned him around and had him seeing things a different way. So I'm wondering if you took anything from that conversation. Obviously, your book, Sane Space, is filled with examples of why the left is almost unreachable in many ways, or at least many elements of the extreme left. Again, don't want to paint too broad a brush, but then again, some people like Dave Smith and others were actually brought over to libertarianism from the left. So despite your personal experiences, as you detail in the book, Sane Space, you know, was Dave able to convince you in any way of some of the value of reaching out to the left?
Well, my view is do what you're good at. If Dave's good at reaching out to the left, let him do it. I'm just not good at it. Now, that's not to say I haven't converted some people, but it's been entirely by accident, not by design. So that's fine, and I love Dave. But he's the first to admit, as a lot of former leftists are, that the left really is full of problems. Now, if anybody thinks all I do is attack the left, well, all you got to do is look at my book before this one, right, which is called Real Dissent, and most of that book is about the neocons and how terrible they are. So, in fact, for the longest time, people were really getting on my case because I never really attacked Obama because I thought it was just so obvious. Everybody's already attacking Obama. I want to do something that's off the radar a bit. The neocons are terrible and not enough people are attacking them. So I'd focus on that. But now that the left is just in our faces all the time, and I think the Trump age is just an interlude, so I think the left still is the real problem. So I've shifted a bit of my emphasis. But my point about the left was that they, ever since the French Revolution, it's been their desire, basically, to centralize regimes and then ram their ideas through and force people to live and think and speak in a certain way. And that is their goal. The idea that they would simply retreat and say, well, as long as San Francisco can be the way I want it, I'm perfectly happy if other people live other ways. They're not. They are imperialists in that way. They are cultural imperialists. Now, there was one drama queen on Facebook who tagged me and gave me this whole song and dance about, oh, if Tom Woods had his way, I would never have become a libertarian, blah, 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 blah. Yeah, but you know, that's what's so funny is that 99% of leftists who do come my way say, Tom, if anything, you are being too easy on these people. Keep smacking them. And you know, by the way, some of the reasons I changed my own opinions on something was not because people came to me and they were all lovey-dovey and, oh, Tom, you're just a little bit misguided when it comes to war and let me try. No, it was they said, you knucklehead, what's the matter with you? And they would lay out in very punchy, aggressive rhetoric what was wrong with my view. That got my attention and that converted me over. So maybe some people need to be serenaded with wine and cheese, but other people actually do respond when you grab them by the collar and say, now, hang on a minute. I want you to think clearly for once in your life.
Yeah, I don't think anybody would change their foreign policy views if Ron Paul had just come out on a stage at a Republican debate and said, well, I think our foreign policy, I kind of get why we do it. And I think we should have a lot of our military bases, but we sort of need to maybe rethink some of the strategy here. I don't think anybody would have, sort of waken out of a stupor and gone, oh, my God, we need to rethink things. He didn't do that. He said, this is wrong. We're directly causing terrorism. This needs to stop. We need to bring all our troops home now. It's a completely different message. So that's really more the approach you're taking to addressing the left. Whether they have good intentions or not, you think they need to be approached with a very direct message of why you think their view is wrong and not with, as you said, the cheese and the crackers.
And also, frankly, the cheese and the crackers. I like that. Yeah, strawberries and
cream. I love cheese and crackers. Just might not be the way to win me over on certain things.
Yeah, no, that's right. But also, I think it's important to show that we're not intimidated because they do. I mean, yeah, I know the right wing has its issues, but they're not trying to make me use certain words and terrorize me and get me fired from a university and whatever. I mean, there are a few right-wing hysterics on some issues, but by and large, they're not doing that. Nobody's shouting down a left-wing speaker on any campus. We all know that. Everybody knows that. The whole country knows that nobody is living in fear of right-wing students. So I think it's important for us to be bold and blunt as a way of saying, you have not succeeded in intimidating me. If anything, you've emboldened me to be tougher and more obnoxious than I was before. So congratulations.
Tom, one more thing I want to touch on, and then we'll let everybody out there know how they can get Sane Space. But I'm not sure if you saw, there was a little bit of a recent flap, which started by an appearance on this program by Nicholas Sawark, the head of the Libertarian Party. And he had mentioned, we were just kind of talking about libertarian leaders and sort of, how they are viewed by people. And he kind of made a remark that, this is after I had said something positive about Ron Paul. And he said, even Ron Paul's not perfect because he supported DOMA. He supported some things that aren't really libertarian in view, and he used states' rights as the reason. And this kind of set off a firestorm of people really going after Nick Sawark about that issue, about states' rights. And it does kind of tie back to your first appearance on this program 2 years ago, because I actually, at that time, if you recall, I asked you a sort of a hypothetical scenario about if the federal government just decided to end the war on drugs overnight, and every state said, yeah, what are we doing? This is crazy. But one state was just a holdout and said, nope, right herein, I don't want to smear any state, but let's just say Alabama. Here in Alabama, we're going to enforce the heck out of this thing. And I asked, would you then support almost a federal nullification going sort of the reverse way that we typically speak of nullification, because it's really the right thing. We're against the war on drugs. I've kind of laid out a lot here for you, but I'm wondering if you had, thought that issue through a little bit more, or if you had seen that recent conversation regarding states' rights, and how do you reconcile this states' rights issue with sort of situations where the federal government might actually be doing the right thing, and a state might be doing the wrong thing from the libertarian view, but that might conflict with sort of the constitutional view or the sort of strategic view that we should support states' rights at all times.
Right. I would be inclined to say that I would favor, in the case of Alabama, by the way, where I used to live, I'll just say a kind word for them, in that when Angel Raich went to the Supreme Court over medical marijuana, they submitted an amicus brief on behalf of her saying that even though we don't want medical marijuana, we think it's a legitimate position for another state to take. And so, that's far more open-minded than almost any progressive state is toward the red states.
Sure.
We don't favor it, but we think it's okay for you to favor it. But anyway, I would favor in that case civil disobedience in that state. What I am very hesitant about is ever thinking of the federal government as being my savior. Because I just don't see that ending well. And moreover, yes, it's true. Of course, states, individual states are going to do terrible, rotten things. And that's true whether you have right-wingers in charge or left-wingers in charge. Like Maryland, Tom DiLorenzo is complaining about the commies in Maryland constantly. So he spends as little time there as he possibly can just to teach. But when we look at the overall, what's the overall record of centralized government, was we're told that states' rights, so-called, which is just shorthand. Obviously, we know states don't have rights. It's just a shorthand phrase. I wish people would stop going hysterical about a shorthand phrase. But the idea is, when we look at the history of centralized government, and then we look at the history of states' rights and federations, we're supposed to believe that states' rights gives you all these local oppressions. And it can give you local oppressions. They're still states, so they are going to do terrible things. But when I look at, for example, the record of that minorities have had living in different societies, it's true that Black Americans, for example, suffered many indignities, not to mention outright slavery in the U.S. That is true. Well, what's been the record in centralized societies? Have there never been cases of people being enslaved in highly centralized societies? To the contrary, we've seen some of the worst genocides and outrages perpetrated on people. I mean, I don't have to be reduced to mentioning Nazi Germany, which everybody mentions, and it's almost to the point where you get laughed at if you bring up Nazi Germany because it's so obvious. So I can look at the Soviet Union. I can look what happened. The Ukrainians were a minority in the Soviet Union. They were deliberately starved to death, millions of them, in the early 1930s. And I've, in some of my speaking, I've given example after example after example. I mean, of course, I, being half Armenian, am particularly sensitive to the threat of centralized states because of what the Ottoman Empire did to the Armenians in the early 20th century. So it's not like the centralized states have an amazing record of respect for minorities. To the contrary, their record is even worse. So when if you're asking me, do I have to choose between the two? I don't really like that choice. But just given the record and given the logic of the thing, I'll take the greater number of smaller units and go from there. In fact, that's why I think F.A. Hayek once said that in the future, liberty is most likely to flourish in small states.
All right, Tom. Well, before I let you go, I definitely want to make sure everybody knows how they can find a copy of Sane Space, because it's a really fun read and it's a really quick read. I mean, I literally read it in an afternoon. So it's a very, very easy book to get through. And it really gives you a lot of valuable insight on a variety of issues, a lot of stuff you're going to hear from your lefty friends, if you have any, or maybe just on Facebook, depending on the circles that you're moving. So how can people get a copy of Sane Space?
Well, it is a very short little book. It's one of my free ebooks. I've released a bunch of them. This is by far the shortest. You can get through it in no time at all. And it's just, you can just go to sanespacebook.com. Obviously, it's a play on safe space. So it's sanespacebook.com. Don't cost you nothing.
Great, Tom. Well, I do appreciate you coming back on the program. It's always a pleasure to listen to you either here one-on-one or by listening to the Tom Woods Show. Is there anything else you got going on that you'd like to promote to our listeners before I send you off on their way here?
Well, you might check out my whole span of free books. Now, I'm doing something I'm not supposed to do. I'm only supposed to give out one link. That's what they tell you, the gurus. Give out one link.
Screw the
rules. Don't confuse people. Well, you know what? I think your listeners are smart enough to take two links.
I think so. I think they can.
You know what?
It.
Yeah, it's Mark Claire. Come on now. So the other link is tomsfreebooks.com. So if, you know, you're all done reading Sane Space, you say, I got to have more of this. Tomsfreebooks.com is where to go.
All right, so be sure to check out both those links if you guys out there can handle it. And I'm sure you're also smart enough to find the Tom Woods Show, Liberty Crest, Classroom, and all of Tom's books, too. But just in case you're not, I'll link to them in the show notes today over at lionsofliberty.com/288. Tom, it's a pleasure as always. Keep up the great work and keep on roaring.
Thank you, Mark. You too.
All right, everybody, here is the announcement. We are fast approaching the 5-year anniversary of what I like to call my dashboard university for libertarians, libertyclassroom.com. And I like anniversaries. And on this particular anniversary, I'm going to be making an offer that will not be made again, period, will not be made again. Maybe when we hit 10 years, but that's so far into the future, it may as well never happen. So this basically is never going to happen again. We have at Liberty Classroom a whole bunch of courses. This is not the Ron Paul curriculum, by the way. That's a homeschool program. This is more of like a adult enrichment site for everybody who feels like you've suffered from educational malpractice in your life. Liberty Classroom is for you. And it's got courses taught by me and by other guests of the show, Bob Murphy, Brian McClanahan, Kevin Gutzman, Jeff Herbener, Brad Berzer, GP Manish, and Jared Casey. It's just amazing. It's amazing. It's ridiculous how much you get there. Well, we have a master membership that is a lifetime membership, gets you everything we ever create. Plus, it includes the hundreds and hundreds of videos and audio files I created for the Ron Paul curriculum. which, by the way, these are all suitable for adults. You will not feel talked down to. So you get all of that, and I am dropping the price way lower than it normally is. Plus, I'm going to throw in some bonuses, including several of my physical books that I will ship to you signed and personalized. So this is a ridiculous deal, will never be repeated, and will only be offered on April 10th, 2017. That is the five-year anniversary of the site. It will be offered that day and that day only. So put that on your Google calendar if you're interested in grabbing this. You're being rewarded for procrastinating, by the way, and waiting to get this, because you're going to get the best deal plus the best bonuses I've ever offered. So April 10th, check out libertyclassroom.com and the master membership. Of course, if you grab Sane Space, my ebook, that'll put you on my mailing list, and that will remind you on April 10th, today's the day. And by the way, on April 10th, I'm going to be emailing you a lot. On April 10th, there's going to be an email from me quite a bit during the day. So either get your finger ready to click the delete button or open them and enjoy all the infotainment, or just unsubscribe from the newsletter. However you want to cope with the onrush of emails that is coming to you on that day, go ahead and cope. But this is a big deal. It's a high-quality product. I worked my tail off on this thing for a long time, and now I am making this tremendous offer. Yeah, I'm going to really, really let you know about it, and I'm going to wear down your resistance, and you're going to say, of course, I'd be crazy not to get this thing. You're darn right. All right, so that's coming up on April 10th. Grab the free ebook that we talked about in today's episode at sanespacebook.com, and I'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.